Today we're going to continue our study on the Sermon on the Mount. We're going through the book of Matthew, and we're in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to be in the Sermon on the Mount for a while, as long as it takes. Remember, what Jesus is doing here is he's comparing the Israelite kingdom under the law, ideally, because they didn't do it, to what his kingdom, his spiritual kingdom, looks like. So what Jesus is doing is contrasting. The best you can do in the kingdom is this. Or in the Israelite kingdom, this is what God told you to do to live. But in my kingdom, hey, I'm the king. I get to make the rules. And he's saying, that's why he says, you have heard it this way, but I'm telling you it's this way. In his kingdom, there's a different way of doing things. There's really only one rule in the kingdom. And what is that? Yeah, I'm only doing that because I'm trying to suck on the candy and I'm using all the delay time. But yeah, it's sacrificial love for the benefit of others. That's it. I mean, if you do that, that sums up all the law and the prophets. See, sacrificial love for the benefit of others. What's another way you could say that? Love one another as Christ has loved you. Or the golden rule, which is? Don't say he who has the gold makes the rule. No, the real golden rule. You know, see, the golden rule is just sacrificial love for the benefit of others. There are multiple ways to say the same thing. If you really are concerned about other people loving them, you're not going to make these mistakes that the law is trying to prevent you from doing. So when people say, well, Jesus is just making the law more strict, no, he's not. He's saying, you don't need that thing at all if you do it my way. In my kingdom, it's supposed to be done differently. So we're continuing to look at this as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. So I'm going to cover a few topics this morning. Larry was wondering what the title of the sermon was going to be. It's Rules of the Kingdom Part 2, whatever you want. I told him if you really want a different title, how about Lust, Adultery, and Swearing? Sorry, that's what we're covering this morning. Try to show you what's really going on behind the scenes, what Jesus really wanted to teach you here. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So this is the part we normally think of when we hear this verse, but what's more important is what comes later. It's the explanation. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. Can you believe Jesus said that? Now, I know a lot of people say, I do everything Jesus told me to do. Trust me, I have not met many people that do this one. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Wow. Okay. Going back to just the first part there. Not committing adultery was the standard of righteousness in the Israelite kingdom. And rightly so. I mean, it's an important commandment. It's important for social stability. It protected the women. It protected the children. I mean, they didn't have any land. They didn't have any possessions. If they got thrown out, they were gone. They were destitute. And if they didn't remarry, there weren't a lot of options for them but to be very poor or turn to prostitution or something else. So, good law. Still a good law. All that, yes, do not commit adultery. Wonderful and fine. But in Jesus' kingdom, he has something even better. In Jesus' kingdom, not committing adultery is not the standard of righteousness. That's not good enough. So what does he have in mind? Well, he's interested in changed hearts. That's what he wants. He wants your heart to be different. He wants your value system to be different. So when we talk about your heart, I'm talking about the sum total of your value system. And he's saying, if your values are wrong in your heart, you know, you can stop doing a lot of things externally, but you're valuing it still. A person can have an ugly heart and keep the law. A person can be rotten on the inside but look good on the outside. Jesus isn't interested in those kind of people filling his kingdom up. We got lots of those kind of people. He's saying he wants to transform us at the value system level. He doesn't want you to just to be obedient to a bunch of external rules. He wants your heart. Why? Because then you'll know him. So what's really going on? He wants you to be changed to be like God. He doesn't merely want you to reflect God's value system, but to hold it as your own. Why legalism doesn't work. Remember that sermon from October? Okay. Remember why that's all foundational. So this isn't just a precautionary step. Somebody says it's precaution. If you don't do this, then you won't do that. You know, God doesn't want you to just to take precautions. He wants you to be different on the inside. It's not just an extra fence. He wants you to turn away from the true sin and its true source. So Jesus is not wanting us to avoid sin only externally. And he's not wanting you to avoid sin only internally. He's not interested in the avoidance of sin. He wants you to be good. There's a complete difference, isn't there? If you're good, you don't want to sin. If you're avoiding sin, that means you really still want to do it. You're just avoiding it. And that's how most people teach the text. But Jesus wanted transformation. So he wants people to treat others, to treat the other people in their life in a good way, flowing from a good heart. Wait a minute, you're saying, you've lost me. What has this got to do with treating other people in a good way? We get to the heart of the matter. Now, it'd be never good to commit adultery, right? It's not good for you. It's not good for the other person. It's not good for the other people in your lives. What is the essence of what adultery does? It exploits somebody else, sometimes mutually, but it's exploitation of another for the gain, your own gain at their expense. Tied usually to at least bodily appetite, sometimes to having people like you, and also to having your own kingdom, power, and control. Three areas of temptation all covered. But what's the real issue here? Because we still haven't gotten down to it. Jesus wants to show the evil heart that produces the evil action, and that's what needs to change. So what happens in adultery, and why is it so wrong when it takes root in one person's heart? I mean, so what? So what if it's just in your heart? What if nobody knows about it? You're not committing adultery. It's just in your own heart. What's the big deal? You want to exploit the other person. So when it starts one place, what does the lustful person attempt to do? The lustful person attempts to export his value system to the object of his lust or her lust. That's what happens. So what I'm doing right now is I'm teaching you how this evil thing works. When one person becomes lustful in their heart, they attempt to exploit it to that object of their lust. So it becomes a mutual lust. Because adultery will never happen until that occurs. You see that? So what's really happening when it forms first in the heart of one person, and why it's so wrong, and why Jesus wants to address it there? What you do when you begin to cultivate lustful feelings towards somebody else, you will begin to cause that other person to enter into your sin at the lust level as well. That's what happens. That's the first real step toward adultery. When it starts in one person's heart, there's no way they're going to commit adultery with somebody else unless they can get that other person to join them in the mutual value that they hold in their own heart. There must be a transmitting of the sinful feelings to the other person. What lust then does? Lust is an attempt to lead another person into sin. That's what it is. It's where it starts. Now, of course, there's people who are just plain all lustful and they get together in lustful situations and, you know, they've already broken down the whole barrier because they already shared the sinful value. But the whole aspect of seduction, if you go to even the book of Proverbs and you study what's going on there, the whole idea of seduction is to exploit another person, to put within the heart of the other person your value first so that you can exploit them and use them. That's what's going on. That's the nature of it. And that's the protection of it. See, if you don't allow the lustful feelings to happen on your own part, even if you're the object of somebody else's subduction, you will be saved. But it's also the thing to be wary of. If you notice that somebody's offering seduction to you, you know what's going on. You be aware and you don't say, oh, it's just no big deal. It's just the way this person is. That person's dangerous, and you know that what that person's beginning to do in your own mind is plant the seeds of lust too. Nobody's nodding, but I think you understand what I'm talking about. I'm trying to keep a little level higher than everybody here present this morning. So why does Jesus recommend self-mutilation? Okay, a lot of discussion on this one, of course. Some say, well, it's hyperbole, right? Just way over the board speech. Yeah, just like Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me. Yes, it's hyperbole. He has nothing in mind about you actually being like him. Most of what Jesus said, of course, is hyperbole, right? Everything he says about sin, not just hyperbole. Love one another? Ah, hyperbole. You know what? Why do we want this to be hyperbole? Because it's just so over the top, Jesus. Now, they might be right. Maybe it's hyperbole, but I don't think it is. I don't think it is. Now, I also don't think Jesus really wants you to go and do this. But what he's saying is if you can't control yourself, it would be better for you. I mean, think about it. He's just showing a contrast. It would be better to physically remove the ability to sin than to go to hell. That's the only thing he's really trying to show here. That's how bad a situation you're getting yourself into. The extension is this, is that some sin is so destructive against others that you should harm yourself rather than others. See, now you see how it's tied to the lust. The whole goal of what lust does, lust begins to export its lust so that it may harm that other person for its own benefit. That's what the nature of it is. And Jesus is saying, if you're going down the road to harm another person, you're better to harm yourself before you let that happen. See the connection now? Are you beginning to follow how that's connected? It's better to harm yourself than to harm another. Jesus says at a different place, better to put a millstone around your neck and be cast into the sea than to cause somebody else to sin. That's all he's saying here. He's using different language. Because do you think then he's really talking about a millstone around your neck being cast into the sea? Yes! Hyperbole, right? Okay, whatever. You sort that out. The point is, it's better to sacrifice yourself and to protect others from your own exploiting them. And there you have the sacrificial love and the exploitation. If you have a sinful heart that you can't even control, better to sacrifice yourself than to exploit another and hurt them. Sacrificial love dictates that you be willing to suffer rather than you harm others in your sin produced by an untransformed heart. How many people still have some parts of their hearts untransformed this morning? And the rest, come on, reach higher, kids, because you're little liars. All right, stick up. You're all, you know, we all know that. And the point is, there's parts of us that aren't transformed. You also know those are the parts that you injure other people with, don't you? The untransformed parts of your heart that lead you to say things that aren't right, that lead you to treat a person in an unkind way. You see, it's the untransformed parts of us that hurt other people. And Jesus is saying, yeah, there's going to be parts of you that are untransformed. Those are specifically the parts you better become sacrificial in so that you don't hurt each other. You got a problem with speech? Sacrifice your own tongue by shutting up. Right? You don't need to cut your tongue off. Sew your lips shut, maybe. But shut up before you do evil with your mouth. Sacrifice the freedom to speak that you may protect another from the evil that still dwells in your heart. Of course, the ideal situation is to be transformed and treat one another in the right way. Sin begins in the heart. It begins in the imagination, in a person's value system. That's the place God seeks to change, first of all, in order to heal the problem. Well, following along, this is the idea of divorce. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. This is taken from, again, from the law. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the grounds of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery. Whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. We're going to cover divorce much later on when we get to Matthew chapter 19. There's a very extended passage on divorce, and I'll teach it there. Here, what Jesus is saying is that your action of divorcing someone causes them to do wrong. So saying in the case of a husband and wife, especially we've got to go into the first century culture. Remember I said earlier, if there's a divorce for that woman, and any children that will be sent off with her, she doesn't have a lot of choices but to remarry. All right? She doesn't have that income real. She doesn't have any property. She doesn't have stuff. The rights of women were very minimal. Rights of children even far less. And so the best thing she could do would be to remarry. Now, if she isn't already committing the sin of adultery and you divorce her and she remarries, therefore she would be committing adultery at that point in the sense that she's not with her initial husband. That's all Jesus is saying here. Most women would have to remarry in the first century. And what you are doing by divorcing that person is causing them to do something that would be wrong. It's really tied to the last one, see? It's the same idea. How can you have the love of God in you if you're willing to cause another person to sin? I mean, if you just back it up, even before causing and worrying about the whole idea of sin, you know, your sacrificial love should be wanting to help somebody become better, to become good, rather than throwing them out destitute, which is what your divorce would do. You're not pushing people farther into sin. Of course, I'm not covering all the issues of divorce. The only idea that I'm covering here is just the one tied to this that Jesus is doing this morning. When you, he's talking to people again, the first century culture, to divorce somebody there would be to put them into a situation that may lead them, or very probably will lead them, into a situation that will cause them to compromise other moral values that they hold, just in order to survive. High degree of temptation, at least. Okay. Last one. Oaths. Again, you've heard it said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. Is this tied to the commandments that says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain? That doesn't mean using God's name as a swear word. It's the idea of oaths. Problem is we have the word swear, and we have two meanings for it now. We have swear and oath, which is where it came from, and then we have cussing. The word's better to use a cussing. So it's using God's name as a cuss word. Often when we hear people interpret it, you shouldn't use God's name as a cuss word. So of course it's not talking about that. It wouldn't even enter into their minds to use God's name as a cuss word. So it was using God's name as an oath. As a promise. So that's what this is talking about here. The people had the idea that they knew they couldn't say, I swear to God that I will fulfill this promise to you. They said, yeah, but I really don't want to keep that promise. I need a loophole just in case things don't work out the way. I know. You know, I don't want to use God's name because it's so precious. So I will, when I make this oath to you, I'm going to use something else like, oh, heaven. I swear to heaven. Now, you know that what I really mean is, you know who. But what I'm going to really say is heaven. And then later on, when I break my word to you, I say, well, I didn't say God. I said heaven. Or the temple, or the altar, or the sacrifice in the altar. And whatever loophole I'm looking for, to make a promise, whether in God's name or not, when you have no intention of fulfilling it, is exploitation. That's all it is. You want something from the other person without giving them what's equally theirs. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. Do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Now again, some people take this very literally, and they won't swear an oath even in the court of law. You know, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? You know what? That's really not what it's talking about here, and you're fine to do that. Don't worry about it. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. That's just not what it's about. If you look through the rest of the New Testament, you will see people using oaths and you know, as God is my witness kind of language. That's really not the fullness of what's at stake here. The point is, to get around breaking the commandment, the Jews were using an oath that sounded like it was in God's name, but really wasn't. Saying they're the ones who are guilty, truly are guilty. They're looking for these loopholes to break their promises. And then they could say, technically I didn't break the law. You know, we don't have to take an oath to do that. Have you ever met a person Two, they'll use vague enough language so that they can deny what they really said to you later on. Or they'll say something and try to make you believe that from the words you were using. Their intent was clear, in other words. But later on they say, well, those weren't my words. My real words were this, this, this. And then they'll give an alternate interpretation to their words. That's what he's talking about. People who wanted to lie without breaking the law. And what is lying? Lying is wanting the benefits of relationship without actually sharing the value system the relationships are based on. The Essenes, these were people who were living the same time as Jesus and John the Baptist. They taught that if you needed to back up your words with an appeal to God, you were already condemned. If it takes an oath to God, you know, to say, God as my witness, basically, it's like saying, you know, well, to tell you the truth, as opposed to the 99% of everything else I say. That's what he's saying. If you have to say, God is my witness, about the next thing that you're going to say is true, nobody trusts you anyway. You've already blown it. If your word can only be trusted when you swear to God, nobody believes you. Jesus said that in his kingdom, truth-telling was the issue. That's all. He's saying, people in my kingdom don't look for ways to wiggle out of their word. People in my kingdom just tell the truth. When somebody in my kingdom say yes, you know it's a yes. And when they say it's no, you know it's a no. Because they're using really plain language. They don't use lawyer speak. The words are simple and unequivocal. Unequivocal. Am I getting this word wrong now? Your yes is yes and your no is no. There's no deceit in it. You're not attempting to trick anybody by what you say. The layer of complexity and deception is removed. That's what it means to be in his kingdom. That's how people in his kingdom treat one another. But Jesus is also saying a little more than that. And I like to point out, where are oaths used? In courts of law, in the human legal systems. That's when we use them, in earthly kingdoms. They're for legal matters of the law. But in Jesus' kingdom, there is no legal matters of the law. There's no suing one another in Jesus' kingdom. There's laying down your life for another person. There's sacrificial love. Well, what are you going to do? I sue you so I can be more sacrificial to you? Because that's the only lawsuit that you could actually bring. In Jesus' kingdom, there are no legal matters of the law. There's no law to enforce. There's no legal system to enforce it. There's no need for an oath. There's no need for an oath in Jesus' kingdom. And that's what he's trying to get to the point here too. Jesus wants us to be honest and share relationship based on truth rather than lies. So let's sum up what you saw here this morning. Lust causes another to commit adultery, plants the seeds of lust in the other person's heart. Divorce causes another person to commit adultery. Lying oaths are meant to exploit others. See, three forms of exploitation. Opposite of Christ's value system. Sacrificial love does not cause others to sin. Really, that's the whole point of all these things. Sacrificial love doesn't cause other people to sin. So what Jesus is commanding here isn't stuff that's enforceable in earthly kingdoms. If you want to be in the kingdom of God, you have to really want his value system. You really want to be like him. Sinful people look for loopholes in the law. And you have to continuously update the law, right? All the time to cover all those loopholes that people are always looking for. But in Jesus' kingdom, he doesn't have to keep doing that. You see why he doesn't have to keep adding rule upon rule upon rule upon rule? There's only one rule in the kingdom. Sacrificial love for the benefit of others. Love one another as I have loved you. That's it. One idea of sacrificial love trumps all evil and all exploitation. course, you need examples, and that's what Jesus is giving here, so you know what it looks like when you live it out. And you also need to see how it differs from the Mosaic Law, so that you begin to understand what Jesus is all about here is about transformation of the heart and not legalism. A lot of Christians just want the rule to follow. That's why Jesus didn't give you a bunch of rules to follow. He gave you an impossible one to follow. But he didn't give you a whole bunch of stuff that, yeah, on the outside you could look good. Well, you could be like the Pharisees, Jesus said, like dead men's bones on the inside. Legalists are concerned about whether their actions are right or wrong. You see this all the time in discussions when people talk about ethics. Well, is it legal? Who cares if it's legal? Lots of things are legal, they're just still unethical. The problem is people don't have any guide in their life. They have to be guided by the legal system of the land because they don't have a moral system of their own to live by. But in Christ's kingdom, we have a moral value system. Sacrificial love for the benefit of others. Now, I don't care what the law says. Because now, I could be keeping the law, but breaking the rule of the kingdom. The law's no help, no guide to me, earthly ideas. Jesus is concerned about what your actions do to others. If your actions cause others to do what's wrong, that's your problem. That's your fault. That's your sin. Now, note, in James chapter 1, God never causes anybody to sin. That's what James lays out right at the beginning. And really, the book of James is a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. So what is going on in James' mind? He wants to lay it right at the beginning. God doesn't cause anybody to sin. God never causes anybody to sin. God doesn't make people sin. God doesn't tempt you to sin. Now do you see what James is talking about and why that's connected to this? What's Jesus saying? You don't tempt other people to sin with your oaths and with your lustful heart and by committing divorce if that leads to further sin. See that? What does it mean to be like God? It means to not cause other people to sin, not tempt other people to sin. That's what Jesus is driving at here. You can't legislate against something like that. It has to flow from the inside. If your heart is untrustworthy, then your life will be untrustworthy as well. God wants us to have hearts that he can fully trust. Hearts that say, I will do no harm to my neighbor. Well, we're going to have communion this morning, and then we'll close with our hymn. I was raised in a church where, man, when we had communion, it was a scary thing. Because, man, if you had sin in your life, you were going to die. That was this somber occasion. That's not what we do here. I think that's a total misinterpretation of the passage. What we like to understand here is the gospel has two parts to it. I know it's got five. There's two parts to the gospel. There's the part that God does for you, and there's part that you do for one another. The part that God does for you is his sacrificial love for you at the cross, and that's what the blood or the cup represents. The bread we take from one loaf because we're to be reminded we're one body. And that's about the sacrificial love we're supposed to have for one another. That's what the new covenant means. That we take what God has done for us and we pass it on to one another. That's why there's one loaf. It's the sacrificial love we're to do. Let's take the bread together. By taking the bread, that's your commitment to be one body, to love one another as Christ has loved you. The cup, it's the new covenant Christ established for us at the cross. Right? The rule of sacrificial love applies to the king just as much as it applies to us. This was him doing it for us. Let's take it together. Lord, we thank you for your great grace given to us at the cross and the great grace given to us in the church, that you've left us with one another, that we may love one another as you have loved us, that you will be glorified in this world, and that all people will know that, Father, you have sent your Son into the world to save us.